This is Ken Kimmel, The Grail Wound, Healing the Split Between Father and Son, Eros and the Beloved, September 16th, 2011.
I want to thank the Jung Society for inviting me here. I've been associated with the Jung Society since the early 90s on the board for a few years, and I'm very grateful for their support for me tonight, and it's really good to be here tonight. I'll be sharing excerpts from chapters 1 and chapters 11 primarily of my new book. And it focuses on the Grail legend. So what I think I'll be doing tonight is I'll be reading from the text for about 25 minutes, and we'll stop and we'll discuss, so you don't have to hear reading for 45, 50 straight minutes. And then we'll go on with the second half. And they're divided basically in two sections. One has more to do with the mother complex and the boy, the puera ternus, the eternal youth. And then the second part has to do with sort of the transforming of Eros in a man's psyche and the transcendence of narcissism, which develops from the first part around the mother-son relationship. And then the emergence of the synex, or the archetypal old man, and the integration of the puer and the synex in every man will lead to development, really, of a deeper sense of manhood, capacity for humility, the capacity to love, the capacity to surrender in relationship, and so forth. It's very interesting that a great number of women really appreciate this work because it helps them to understand the dynamics of the men that have been in their lives, fathers, lovers, husbands, children, sons, so forth. So I'm glad to see so many women here. Appreciate it. What I'd like to do is kind of begin with a prelude before I actually begin the reading. And it's a little bit of history, so you get a context for the Grail legend. So through countless years of war, Roman influence in Western Europe was succeeded by Norman rule. And the Normans were descendants of Viking marauders who basically, colonized Normandy and England. And William the Conqueror became the King of England in the 11th century. And in the midst of all this war and bloodshed, something miraculous began to emerge around this time, the 11th and 12th centuries. There was a great resurgence of art and poetry, music, creativity, architecture, and the practices of courtly love. These are all aspects of what Jungians might call the emergence of the feminine. And nothing like this had happened for, more than a millennia since the Greek and Roman eras. So this was an essential time in history. At the center of this Renaissance arose this towering spirit. Her name was Eleanor of Aquitaine. And she married Louis VII, who was the King of France. And later, after divorcing Louis, she married the King of England, Henry II. He became king after they were married. And he was a descendant of William the Conqueror. So her courts became the courts of love. And from them arose the practices and philosophy of courtly love, romantic love. From her troubadours and minstrels, these ideals of true love spread throughout Europe. One of her daughters, Mary, became the Countess of Champagne. Yes, the same Champagne. And her court poet, Chrétien, or Christian, of Troyes, was commanded by his lady to compose the Lancelot and Guinevere stories, and also what was called the Count of the Grail. A story originating from a troubadour in the south of France in Provence. The Grail legend has been told and retold many, many times, and I'll be reading from excerpts of my book that describe the later German version of the tale by Wolfram. And at this point, I'd like to make a formal apology to Wolfram von Eschenbach for appropriating one of the great stories in Western literature to describe a very narrow field of inquiry. It's much broader than my inquiry, this masterwork. That is the internal psychological aspects in the male psyche, the puera ternis, the eternal youth, and that of the synex, the old man, personified by young Parsifal and his uncle Anfortas, the king of the Grail Castle. And from their psychological union, certain elements may emerge that can help a man to transcend his narcissism and alienation, and from that achievement may deepen his capacity to love and to serve life. So I'm hoping that old Wolfram can forgive me. So the name of this chapter is Parsifal and the Grail King. Parsifal, Wolfram von Eschenbach's version of the medieval Grail legend, written in the first years of the 13th century, is a tale of a royal boy child, fatherless at birth, who is subjected to an all-enveloping mother. She adores his purity as well as his phallus. She substitutes her child for the husband she has lost. Within the story are the seeds of transcendence of the mother complex, the emergence of masculine agency, and what I call relational eros. In the beginning of this Arthurian tale, Queen Hersiloid, 9 months pregnant with Parsifal, awakens writhing and wailing in pain from a terrible dream foretelling her beloved husband's heroic death in battle. The author von Eschenbach writes, and this is her dream, she thought a falling star was sweeping her into the air, where fiery thunderbolts struck upon her with violence. These flew at her all at one time, and then her braids crackled and sang with sparks. With a crash, the thunder made its rush and burst in a gust of burning tears. As she came to consciousness, there a griffin wrenched her right hand away. Then all was changed. She imagined fantastic things, how she was nurse to a dragon that tore her womb, and how this dragon took suck at her breasts, and how he swiftly fled away and left her so that she never saw him again. Her heart was bursting out of her body, and yet her eyes could not help but see that thing of terror. This is a dream written in the 13th century. This prescient dream afflicted the radiant queen just at the moment when her husband's squire arrived at the castle to tell the sad tale of his lord's death. It unleashed unending grief and sorrow for her dead lover, and even alluded to her future abandonment by her son when the time would come for him to leave her. In this moment of bad tidings, Hersiloid fell into a listless, suicidal depression, not caring if she or her unborn child would live or die. She barely survived Parsifal's birth. At the last moment, she regained consciousness, prayed for the strength to live, and gave birth to the child who was the fruit of her and her husband's love. Upon her recovery from the traumatic birth and the grave events preceding it, the queen took her baby boy in her arms, and she and all the ladies in waiting gazed intently at the little penis between his legs. Quote, "He could not be other than fondled and cherished, for he was possessed of the organ of a man." End quote. Through her child, Parsifal, Hersiloid was both mother and wife, to her dead husband, whom she bore within her and gave birth to from the seed of his life. One can only imagine the traumatic beginnings and the ongoing instability suffered by a newborn male subjected to such a collapse and burdened at birth with his mother's depression, anxiety, and the trauma of loss. It brings to mind Bion's idea that the absence of a containing mother is a psychological catastrophe. One might understand the powerful tendency of the mother to pour all of her love into the child, to protect him and to control him as a defense against the unbearable pain and fear of reenacting her own abandonment. As her child grows up, any signs of his autonomy or need for separation poses a threat to his mother's stability. By inducing guilt in him for causing her the pain of reliving her loss, she impedes his growth. In the story, Parsifal was shielded by his protective mother from all the dangers and hardships of a warrior's life and raised in the woods as a simpleton. This prevented him from growing up and leaving the nest until fate intervened, as it always does. Beneath the mother's veil of protectiveness was an aggression that annexed her son's unique identity and turned him into an object of her needs and desires, signified by the flurry of the queen's handmaidens who excitedly fondled her baby boy's genitalia. The boy who's over-identified with the role of the puera ternus, the eternal youth, lives in the charmed circle of the mother who keeps him all to herself. Lurking beneath her charming surface is a devouring mother. That primal density, as Hans Lowald says, carried by the mother and personified in our unconscious tendency to sink back into inertia and passivity. Thus, the birth of consciousness is prevented by our fear of the uncertainty that may bring danger. When the son introjects his mother's depression or her abject terror of abandonment, his narcissistic defenses are triggered through his identification with the puera ternus. In narcissism, the traumatic failure and loss of maternal containment at birth, as in Parsifal's story, impedes the development of core structures in the infant's psyche that allow the infant to negotiate differences between self and other. In consequence, the ego identified with the puera ternus becomes inflated by a highly primitive and unarticulated mother complex. The mother complex then acts more as a narcissistic defense against the danger of re-traumatization that accompanies the uncertainty of mutual relationships, where there are no guarantees in mutual relationships. In reaction to the child's early trauma, in other words, the unarticulated mother complex loses its ability to mediate as a self-structure between conscious and unconscious, or self and other. Instead, it induces states of ego fusion with the mother and withdrawal into fixed emotional patterns that shut down possibilities for experiencing the multiple dimensions found in relations with people seen as whole persons. The complex's unarticulated core resembles Julia Kristeva's unknowable affects of the maternal body, existing before word or memory, that are irreparably lost to the infant, but that the child tries to resurrect through imagination. These fantasies of return to the maternal paradise, however, are merely reproductions and imitations that alienate and insulate the individual from his core of experience and his relationships. In the mythic drama of the puer, as it appears in the tale of Parsifal, we find allusions to incest, but the kind of primitive allusions to incest that unfold in this context should be considered symbolic and not concrete or sexual. In the words of Eric Neumann, incest here speaks imaginatively to, quote, a form of entry into the mother, of union with her. It is more a desire to be dissolved and absorbed. Passively, one lets oneself be taken, melts away in the ocean of pleasure. The great mother takes the little child back into herself, and always there stand the insignia of death, signifying final dissolution in union with the mother. Cave, earth, tomb, sarcophagus, and coffin, end quote. In concert with these yearnings for dissolution, the narcissistic mind is stirred by vibrant infantile longings and grand mythic fantasies. What passes for glorious merging with the all-embracing mother, however, is in fact a marriage of death, a disintegration of the self, a victimization, and a crumbling of the integrity of the boundaries of the psyche, which are necessary for maturity and selfhood. The hoped-for stability of an individual identity does not come to pass, and one finds only withdrawal from actual life and oblivion. The longing for return to the mother's body is soon followed by terror and dread. Jung's poetic words poignantly capture this state of longing carried on into later life by the narcissistic mind as it seeks again and again to return for the hoped-for ambrosia of eternal life, despite the inevitable cost of the loss of one's very self. Here's Jung. The puer's eros is passive like a child's. He hopes to be caught, sucked in, enveloped, and devoured. He seeks, as it were, the protecting, nourishing, charmed circle of the mother, the condition of the infant released from every care. No wonder the real world vanishes from sight. End quote. While these are but passing moments of emotional possession, they can distort the perception of reality and fill a man's mind with longing for what might be. What is can be violently denied, for there are times in life when his imperfections, frustrations, and failures can throw him into unbearable despair and panic. If, however, he relinquishes the fantasy of mother coming to the rescue to care for all of his needs and desires, and throws his whole weight into the scales of manhood to fight his way out of her membrane, then he stands a chance of embracing real life and relationships. That road leads to maturation and emotional development. If, on the other hand, the smallest of offenses triggers narcissistic sensitivities that catapult him out of a relationship and send him reeling for cover, then he will reach back for grandiose fantasies while in retreat, because they serve to split him off from any pain. He desires only to sink back into his illusions of mother's soothing paradise. What he ultimately finds there is psychic death, a death of soul. When it lacks its opposite, the cynex, or the old man, the puer is largely negative, unable to bring gravitas to its labile moods. The loss of the father is profound, and the longing to find the father is deep. Parsifal's story continues. By chance, one day while out hunting, the youthful Parsifal sees knights in full regalia galloping by on chargers. From that moment, he knows his purpose. Nothing that his mother could do or say could keep him from it. On the day that he leaves her to become a knight, she dresses him in the sackcloth of a fool, in hopes that King Arthur's court will think him a simpleton and scornfully send him home to his mother unharmed. From a bridge, Herseloid watches Parsifal disappear and then falls to the ground, quote, where grief stabbed her until she died. There's the coming to pass of her dream. The king and the fool are cut from the same cloth. As our own Ladson Hinton notes, quote, "In the same way that humor breaks the ice in a stiff group, the fool prevents the king from becoming trapped in Sinex sterility, or a ritual from becoming constrained and lifeless. The fool brings the fertility of the darkness, the fringes, the paranormal," end quote. It is the fool who acts as scapegoat for human failures. In the mystery cult rituals of antiquity, he was even known to step in as the sacrificial substitute for his king. The king and the fool lie in dynamic relation to one another. The king signifies the stability of known life at the surface and at the center of consciousness, and is the purveyor of established norms and attitudes. The fool or jester is the link to the great unknown that Hinton adds, quote, "deconstructs the certainty of the king," end quote, often through insights disguised beneath pranks, bizarre humor, and foolishness. So I'm going to skip ahead in the story to pertinent to the talk tonight. Upon reaching King Arthur's court, Parsifal, appearing like a dumbling, you know, dressed in sackcloth, defeats a knight in a less than noble way. Then he dons his armor and goes out on his own quest. A pivotal event occurs during Parsifal's adventures. While lost in reverie, his steed leads him to a lake where a fisherman invites him to his castle for supper and a bed. When he enters the castle, everyone appears sad of heart, although, quote, "it seemed to both old and young as though from him a new day shone." And Fortas, his host, lies ill upon a cot facing a massive fireplace for warmth. He greets Parsifal entering the great hall. A squire appears carrying a lance, bleeding from its tip, and great sorrow fills the hall of knights and ladies as he circles its four walls. A solemn, mysterious procession of royal maidens follows, bringing in their midst the Holy Grail in the form of a stone and placing it on a precious garnet and hyacinth stone table before their host. Now, this is a stone, not a cup, that in the Count of the Grail, the Critian's story, it's the cup of Christ that he drank from at the Last Supper, and then blood from him on the cross was taken in that cup. That was the Holy Grail in the French story. This is the German story, and for some reason, Wolfram decided to use a stone. We'll get to that. So next, a marvelous abundance of food and drink of all kinds appears mysteriously in front of the Grail like a horn of plenty. And the 400 knights assembled for this great feast are served in golden bowls. So I imagine if you looked upon this from a bird's eye view, it would look like a marvelous moving mandala. In his youthful immaturity, Parsifal fails to inquire into the nature of his anonymous host's wound. And then the feast ends, and the maidens and queen carry the Grail from the room. Even the Grail, that very perfection of paradise, cannot pierce the death pale surrounding Anfortas, the king of the Grail castle. In his cloistered life within the confines of the castle, he languishes for years upon his cot in perpetual suffering, with only the same unchanging nightly procession of maidens by which to mark the endless days. Anfortas's isolation from the world seems in a way to mirror Parsifal's engulfment by enveloping maternal influences. The maiden's endless procession suggests the narcissistic encapsulation of a wounded and impotent man mired in the mother complex, who suffers yet remains safe in his perpetual sameness. Psychologically, a man may feel as if he is a pawn under the magical influence of the dark mothering principle that keeps him safe but passive, wounded and unchanged, unable to separate. In Parseval's case, he's unable to ask the real question about Anfortas's wound. Parseval's failure to question speaks to that aspect of narcissism that envelops a man in passivity, the avoidance of shame and the fear of disrupting old rituals, of getting in trouble. If the question can be spoken, its truth will pierce the silent acquiescence and fixed repetitions of narcissism. This is the trauma of the other that pierces through our perpetual sameness, penetrates to the core, and breaks the spell of mother-bound eros. Because of Parseval's failed encounter with the wounded king, he betrays his own name, which literally translates as piercing through the middle. After the feast, Parseval takes his leave and is escorted to a lavish bedroom where he readies himself for sleep. His dreams are agonizing and painful, like those of his mother before she learned of her husband's death. He awakens in misery to an empty castle, the night's proceedings seeming like a dream. He dons his armor and runs through the empty hall, screaming for someone to answer him, to no avail. The gates of the castle are wide open, and he mounts his horse and rides over the drawbridge and out of the Grail Castle. As consequences of his failure to speak, shame and deep remorse soon become Parseval's constant companions. He journeys to the encampment of King Arthur, where he is joyously accepted as a member of the Round Table for his valorous exploits upon the field of battle. We might perhaps consider that mastery of the ego world, not of the soul world. His triumph is soon dashed by the arrival of Kundry, the sorceress and messenger of the Grail. Confronting Parseval before the entire Arthurian court, she publicly recounts all of his failures, especially his failure to ask the question that would have released the Grail King from his suffering. As Parseval stands alone, the narrator comments, quote, "What help to him now was his brave heart, his manliness and true breeding. Still another virtue was his, a sense of shame. Real falsity he had shunned, for shame brings honor as reward and is the crown of the soul. The sense of shame is a virtue above all others." End quote. Parseval fails in his task because he cannot bear the shame of a superficial social impropriety. When confronted by Kundry, he suffers the deepest level of shame, failure of integrity. As Hinton writes, quote, "Shame was not seen as an inferior concern of conformists, but a guide to the knight who is serving the most sacred purposes. In thinking of shame as a teacher, it is Parseval's assumption of the mantle of shame that leads to his redemption and transformation." End quote. Parseval bears his greatest wound in that public shaming, which tears away his narcissism and arrogance, brings him to his knees, and sets him on a course to find meaning and to be of service in his life. In Kundry's piercing truth, Parseval is revealed by the gaze of the other. This shocks the autonomy of the ego, placing it in question. As Pepperjack adds, quote, "The ego's ruthless spontaneity is converted into shame, and conscience is awakened." Let's pause here and let that sink in and allow some questions or some comments or some reflections from the reading thus far to... Yes. Might not have had the story. Well, her lack of containment had to do with the trauma prior to birth and at birth. If we think about it in more object relations kind of terms, if we were to, some, which is hard to do, but if we take him as a real person whose mother was suicidal and, you know, clinically depressed and didn't want to live, and then somehow snapped out of it in time to give birth to him, she swings over into this opposite end of overindulgence, over possessiveness, and that and yet he's still somewhere in that place that Kristeva describes as this unknowable place before memory, before time for the infant. It's somewhere in the body, somewhere in the cellular memory that can't be understood, that's experienced this terrible lack of containment, this mother that couldn't be a viable container for him in that time. And then she swings over into complete opposite side where she's over-involved, she controls him. And so the two create this sort of lack of containment. So the opposite of that, perhaps, is the good enough mother who can be upset and sometimes despairing, sometimes depressed, but is able to kind of rebound, is able to provide the containment for the child, the good enough mother, as Winnicott would say, providing the secure beginnings where the child is allowed to adapt, allowed to fail and try again, you know, but with the presence of the mother there to contain, and also having the presence of the father as well, that will be able to stand sometimes in between the mother and the child saying, hey, let him grow up a little bit, you know, let him, you know, take care of himself, don't mother hen him so much, that sort of thing. So does that kind of get to your question?
And so in that way, it might intensify the story. Or it might make the complex that much more complex.
It is complex. We never know. Suicide would say something different about the quality of the man. What he was struggling with in his life and so forth. So anyone have some thoughts about that? Yes, Elizabeth.
Well, I can't help wondering if the child would grow up and with an unconscious or conscious knowledge of the father's suicide, take on this guilt.
Yeah.
That he either caused it or displaced the father, some nefarious sense.
Uh-huh.
And also I'm fascinated by the narcissism of the mother in this case. You know, where this
You noticed father, that, huh?
Well, yeah. I didn't know that. And I wonder if you can speak a little about that.
Well, I think that I do speak about it in the form of how she kind of appropriates him to serve him, like kind of like Alice Miller talks about, that type of mother that, you know, needs the child to somehow take care of the mother in profound ways, and there and in that way protects the mother from having to dealing or working through the grief and loss of her husband's death or suicide, if you will, and prevents him from feeling like he has the autonomy to find his own path. So he had to wait until these, at random, by chance, these knights come riding by in the woods, you know, on these grand chargers, and he's gone at that point. You know, he comes to his senses, in a sense, and he's able to leave her. But, you know, he's been given this message early on that if he leaves her, he'll kill her. So that's quite a narcissistic demand of the mother upon the child to fulfill her needs of not just being her delightful son, but also her husband, her protector, all that. Yeah. Yes.
Adding hers, isn't that kind of this, what we inherit sometimes from fathers when boys don't get that initiation. Because the father, had he disappeared or suicided, is sort of, if Percival never got that initiation, he would have never been able to get out of that mother complex and then deal with real-life relationships. So a father who suicides is someone who says, well, I didn't know how to deal with real-world relationships either, and so I sort of pass that to you.
Yes, that's a good point. It's very good. Yes?
I didn't know exactly what you were going to be talking about tonight, but I know that I was reading this Parsifal tale of the Grail King story, Bishop King story, and then...
Christian's story?
No, actually, it was, I think, Robert Johnson's little...
Okay, so he's sort of...
So he was coming out from a different angle. But then I was looking at the book The Wise Woman, and in The Wise Woman, they referred to the Grail as being menstruating female.
Yeah.
And that made me think, well, for some reason I thought, well, then the Fisher King's wound must be prostate trouble. As you get older, you become a little bit more aware of how difficult that is, if it's a problem for the older male. And,
well, we'll get to that later.
And I don't know what that to do with what you're talking about, but it's just those images that go in my mind.
Well, everyone hear a comment? Well, I think what is really important about all the stories and the myths, for instance, the book uses the Eros and Psyche as a template story. And there have been a dozen or so stories written on Eros and Psyche from the male perspective, where it's, Psyche represents the anima of a man, from the perspective where Psyche represents the... kind of the self, the feminine psyche, dealing with the animus or eros. And so I think you can absolutely, the myths, and like dreams, are like gemstones. They have multiple facets, and we can look at them in many, many ways, but what have meaning to us. So let's move on. So feeling... far too ashamed to stay another minute, with Kundry's admonishment still stinging his ears, Parsifal rides forth from Arthur's encampment to seek the Grail. He prays to God to guide his steed. He comes upon a holy man living in a cave, a man who has renounced all sensuous pleasures. Parsifal learns that this holy man is the brother of Anfortas, the lord of the Grail Castle, and that the two are Parsifal's uncles and his mother's brothers. How about that? Parsifal listens spellbound to the sad tale of his uncle's wounding. Anfortas, the successor to his father as king of the Grail Castle, strayed from the path of sanctity in his youth, choosing to serve the beautiful Orgeluz, whose name means pride or arrogance. As von Eschenbach writes, quote, "Amor was his battle cry, for he desired beyond all restraint and bounds love." He adds, "Love's desire compelled him to it. During a joust, he was wounded by a heathen knight with a poisoned spear pierced through the testicles." Close. The iron remained embedded there. Stricken, he was brought to the Grail. Through its grace, Anfortas staved off death, but he endured endless suffering. The wound had festered, and no cure could ease his pain. Through the hermit's tale, Parsifal learns that his destiny and that of the mysterious Grail King are inexorably linked. Jung discovered the theme of the old poisoned king who is reborn as the royal boy child in the arcane philosophy of medieval alchemy. Mythic imagery and dream language frequently show an old man and young son as one flesh, as they are simply different stages or aspects of the archetypal process of the self. When the old king is dissociated from his life-giving child, the psyche bears his sickness.
According to James Hillman, quote, the negative synex is the synex split from its own puer aspect. He has lost his child. The archetypal core of the complex, now split, loses its inherent tension, end quote. The old hermit reveals love's desire as the sole cause of King Anfortas's castration wound. In the German, the author is referring to Liebe, erotic desire, passionate desire, or what I call elemental eros. And it differs from courtly love, min, which is of a more refined nature and of a quality that I refer to as relational eros. And you might recognize min. Min is the goddess of love, and the name, the word minstrel or minnesinger are troubadours who sing of this level of love, this courtly love. Metaphorical images abound in the next passage that unmistakably point to the elemental realm of Eros and the dark feminine as both the source of the king's sickness and his cure. The holy man describes the Grail attendant's desperate but failed search for a homeopathic remedy for their master. In an attempt to fight fire with fire, they try ancient and mythical cures to heal the king using talismans, herbs, and gems. All these appear unsuccessful. The Grail attendants seek out the sacred bough of the Greek Aeneas. It had overcome the hellfires of the underworld, and perhaps it could quell the, quote, poisonous fires passion within Anfortas as well. So you notice they're equating hellfires with sexual passion. The cure for snake bite is administered next. And this calls to mind Eros, who, when armed with bow and arrows, is described as viperous and fierce by Apuleius. A garnet is then taken from beneath the magical horn of a slain unicorn. The feigned innocence of a pure virgin beguiled and betrayed the fiery, untamable beast. Even the murdering of the animal's primal instinct of life cannot cure poor Anfortas. Next, they use the dragonwort plant to cool the heat of his love wound. It grows from the blood of a slain dragon, another allusion to Eros, fierce and wild and of the dragon breed, who swoops down on airy wing to do his harvesting. So another quote from Apuleius. As with the wild unicorn, they make the sacrifice of that which harms so that it might heal. Eros and Saturn, dragon and king, are of the same kindred blood, as Jung points out in his analogy to the alchemical rebirth. Von Eschenbach, who portrayed the Grail as a stone rather than a cup, was also apparently familiar with alchemy and its philosopher's stone. Quote, this is a quote from Jung, the dragon is the lowest and most inchoate form of the king, is, we are constantly told, at first a deadly poison, but later the alexipharmic itself, end quote. Alexipharmic is Greek for a medicine that wards off. Jung speaks here of the paradoxical nature of the dragon as first a poison and then a cure. The elemental Eros is a venomous dragon, one that consumes the narcissist in insatiable drives and desires. With the union of Synex and the royal boy child, the relational Eros emerges from the ashes as the king reborn, and he and the land are made whole and healed again. Psychologically, from the conflict of opposites, a new thing is created from within the space of the transcendent function. These sacrifices of the unicorn and the dragon suggest that the primal energies of the self may be coming into contact with the human dimension. As Parsifal and Amfortas move toward their ultimate reckoning and resolution. Similarly, in the Book of Lambspring, an alchemical series of woodcuts, the dragon that is first encountered by the warrior is slain. It corresponds to the primeval chaos of the self, the undifferentiated unconscious that's too overwhelming to the ego. It must be, quote-unquote, killed, so that the ego, as Jeffrey Raff writes, may, quote, face the unconscious without being swept away, end quote, and can then effect changes in the unconscious. Jung says, quote, it is not man who is transformed into a god, but the god who undergoes transformation in and through man, end quote. The elemental eros that brings us to ecstatic and inflationary moments of oneness gives way to the human dimension of eros as relatedness, in much the same way that Eros must renounce his incestuous fusion with Venus, his mother goddess, to be with his human bride, Psyche. A further detail in the hermit's story points to the transformative nature of the new moon and its embodiment of dark, ineffable, and volatile energies that break down narcissistic fixity in the synex. Amfortas' suffering is greatest when Scorpio is in ascendance in the night sky during the time of the new moon. The new moon in the text signifies, as von Franz and Emma Jung write, quote, a dark feminine element at the back of the Grail King's wound, end quote. We know that the moon, its phases, and the effects it has upon tides, planting, and even the emotions, lunacy, has long been associated in all times and places with cycles of nature. In the words of the 16th century Hermetic scholar Vigenères, quote, in her conjunction, when the moon is totally darkened for us, she is fully illuminated on that side which faces the sun. This should teach us that the more our intellect descends to the things of sense, the more it is turned away from intelligible things, end quote. What we can't apprehend with our senses may be, in fact, brightly illuminated from a transcendent perspective that we can't understand because it doesn't exist in our frame of reference. Jung adds, quote, the moon standing on the border of the sublunary world ruled by evil has a share not only in the world of light, but also in the demonic world of darkness. The two must be kept in relationship, one unchanging, the other changing. Marginalizing and disavowing the things on the fringes that a man fears or doesn't understand reinforces the psychic split brought about by his wounded and deadened synex. His disavowal divides him from his eros and the mercurial nature of the anima's feeling. Their presence threatens to break down synex attitudes in the ego so that something new and unimagined may emerge. In this way, the darkness of the new moon may be perceived as destabilizing to the fixed sterility of the synex, who recoils from the quote-unquote wickedness he believes to be inherent in the dark feminine, so that he can maintain his life of perpetual sameness. The old hermit divulges one last secret concerning the king's wound. His pain is intolerable when the planet Saturn is at its zenith point in the starry heavens, when the moon is new. At these times, his body becomes as cold as ice, and only the hot poison from the spear tip lying in the wound can draw the cold from him. Here again, the Grail attendants use the very thing that harms the king to try to ease his unrelenting pain. The wounded king, we learn here, lies stricken by unbearable cold due to the influence of the ruling planet Saturn, which signifies the ego's embeddedness in cold and calcifying attitudes that cut off consciousness from the vitality of life. Hillman speaks directly to this Saturnian malaise that grips the psyche in a deadening Synex complex. Quote, "The Synex spirit appears when any attitude we have begins to coagulate past its prime. It is the Saturn within the complex that makes it hard to shed, dense and slow and maddeningly depressing. The madness of the lead poison. That feeling of the everlasting indestructibility of the complex. It cuts off the complex from life and the feminine, inhibiting it and introverting it into an isolation." Hillman's best writing is his earliest writing, my opinion. If we imagine the old king's plight and the degree of his isolation and hopelessness, we see before us a deeply depressed man. Anyone who knows a person suffering from chronic pain, as Anne Fortis is, knows that the steady companion to his suffering is depression. To the medieval mind, lead was the metal associated with the planet Saturn. Quote, "In certain depressions," von Franz writes, "one feels literally like lead. In a heavy depression, one feels unable to get up from one's chair or even open one's mouth to explain that one is depressed." Familiar feeling. Von Franz speaks of Saturn as the god not only of mutilated people and cripples, of which Anfortas is one, but also of artists and creative people. Depression, that is, may also function as a creative process that allows new aspects of the unconscious to emerge. Sometimes, von Franz says, the real energy of life is pressed down into a deeper layer of the psyche and can be reached only in a depression. So in certain analytic situations, she encourages following regression down to the bottom in depressive states until a, quote, "impulse for life and creativeness appears," end quote. Jung writes of Saturn's ambivalence as not only a malevolent planet, but a harbinger of light as well. Quote, "Although astrologically Saturn is a malefic planet of whom only the worst is expected, he is also a purifier, because true purity is attained only through repentance and expiation of sin," end quote. The appearance of Saturn at this stage in the development of the storyline then alludes to the, quote, "coagulation past its prime," end quote, of the negative Synex attitudes. This is then followed by an enantiodromia, a process in which the overabundance of a force inevitably produces its opposite. Saturn's appearance foreshadows union and resolution. The hermit's long tale comes to completion, and Parzival takes his leave from the old man. Late in the story, Parzival is confronted with his shadow other, an unknown and majestic heathen knight who turns out to be his long-lost half-brother, of Middle Eastern origin, Firefist. So the father wasn't so faithful. They meet in an evenly matched joust and declare a truce in which each reveals his identity. The brothers embrace and kiss one another as two missing parts made one again. The brother's appearance is uncanny. His face is described by von Eschenbach as having the markings of the magpie, quote, "black and white and all mixed up," end quote. Great image of shadow, is it not? The shadow is often the carrier of desperately needed masculine qualities that a man requires to free himself from the negative bonds of the mother. This is particularly true for a man who has been raised under the sole influence of women, as Parsifal was. It's important that this shadow companion is Parsifal's older brother, both dark and light, who carries the missing father in his blood. All along, it's the father principle that's been missing in Parsifal's story. And Parsifal has come upon it through the confrontation with his shadow. It's the ego's heroic struggle with the shadow that brings the principles of manhood, maturity, and humility into being. Parsifal is now ready for his final test. After a short time, Kundrik comes to their encampment to escort Parsifal and his brother to the Grail Castle to be its new king. Entering the castle, they are met by joyful throngs. They make their way to Anfortas straight away. In his presence, Parsifal rises to his feet and says, "Uncle, what is it that troubles you?" The words from the lips of the wiser, battle-weary warrior, no longer a simpleton, instantly heal Anfortas. The succession of life begins anew as the old king steps down and the new king ascends to guardianship and lord of the Grail. His beloved wife, Chandruamores, whom he wedded early in his long quest and who bore him two children, joins him there. Parsifal reigns with humility and his son after him. So the story goes. Underlying the reunion of Parsifal and King Anfortas is the psychological union of Puer and Synex. Says Hillman, quote, "Negative Synex attitudes and behavior result from this split archetype, while positive Synex attitudes and behavior reflect its unity," so that the term positive Synex refers merely to a transformed continuation of the Puer. Synex needs the youthful spirit of Puer, and Puer needs Synex to provide order and substance, their continuity signifying the psyche's cohesiveness. No magic talismans could heal the wound of Anfortas. As with narcissism, no grand, ecstatic, or otherworldly encounter could help him. Only in the presence of a humble being could Anfortas be saved. He was healed by human care and compassion from a soul who had learned to bear his own suffering and shame, and who had made Shadow his companion. Parsifal had awakened to his endless responsibility for the other and had thereby become a man worthy of being king. The transformed Eros leads us to the mystery of the other. I'd like to conclude tonight with a poem that Joseph Campbell recorded in honor of Min, the goddess of love, that he describes as he writes, "The world transfiguring sentiment of love as an experience of that transcendent, immanent ground of being beyond duality." So if we recall, Min is the goddess of love, the courtly love image on the one hand, and yet he's alluding to the fact that she transcends duality. And this is the poem by a 13th century minstrel, Walther von der Vogelweide. Pretty good, I could say that. "Min is neither male nor female. She has neither a soul nor a body. She resembles nothing imaginable. Her name is known, herself, however, ungrasped. Yet nobody from her apart merits the blessing of God's grace. She comes never to a false heart. Thank you.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.